MSO News, giving voice to the North Shore. This is North Shore Today for Tuesday, January 30, 2024. Brought to you by Moynihan Lumber. Moynihan Lumber supporting local news coverage and communities on the North Shore. I'm Rick Moore. In today's news, there's a North Shore town making a push to lower the voting age for local elections to 16. The Lynn mayor and a former Salem mayor will be serving on the same new state housing council. And this Friday night, the lights will be staying on later in downtown Newburyport.
I'm Bill Newell, and a bit later in sports, basketball and hockey updates from the North Shore. Rick?
All right, Bill, thank you. Partly cloudy, windy, upper 20s today. High tide Gloucester Harbor, 2:09 p.m. In Swampscott, Select Board member Peter Spelios is concerned about the low turnout levels in his town for local elections.
The decreased in voter participation and anemic voter turnout at the local level has created a dangerous void in our understanding and appreciation for the role of a democratically elected government. Instead, it leaves in place people losing faith in our government, being cynical, being skeptical, and losing their belief in democracy, due primarily to the fact that all they see and all they witness is what they see on social media and in the media about political gridlock, inactivity, and extreme partisanship that has overtaken Washington, D.C. and many state capitals.
Spelios is suggesting that 16- and 17-year-olds be permitted to vote in local Swampscott elections and is hoping to have an article to present at town meeting.
In the coming weeks, a group will be talking with juniors and seniors in the high school and having a discussion with them in the month of February about whether or not Swampscott should be added to the list of growing number of communities asking the state for permission to allow 16-year-olds and 17-year-olds to vote in local elections. I believe it's critical that we invite them into this dialogue and that we have the conversation. We have the opportunity to have these young people make up for the irresponsible problems that us old people have created by not voting. In talking to these young people, we're going to be doing it in classrooms. We're going to be doing it while they're surrounded by advisors, by history teachers, by civic teachers, by professionals that can help them be introduced into the importance of voting. When, where, why, and how. So they don't leave high school without ever being part of the experiment. They're actually in high school being schooled about the importance of the experiment, and they have active involvement while they're here in our school system so that they can come to appreciate why is it important.
Spelios adds that there are many reasons why 16- and 17-year-olds should be voting in local elections.
Why you should want to vote in a local election because you don't want the AP biology class cut. Why you need to vote in a local election because you are sick and tired of the Phillips Park field having holes in it. Why you want to vote in a local election because you are sick and tired of the fact that your street has never been paved. The issues go on, and they are real life examples that get buy-in. When we see results, when we see the impacts of government, we believe in government more. The problem is the only place people are seeing it right now is at the local level. But with the decrease of voter turnout and the decrease of local papers, we aren't witnessing it as much. So people have now associated with government with do nothing. And do nothing means voting doesn't matter. And that is the exact opposite of the truth.
Swampscott Select Board member Peter Spelios noted in his presentation to the Select Board that there are still several hurdles for this to happen, including getting approval from the state. Lynn Mayor Jared Nicholson has been appointed to the Commonwealth's Housing Advisory Council. The Healy-Driscoll administration sent out a press release with this information yesterday. The Lieutenant Governor and former Salem Mayor Kim Driscoll will chair this new committee that includes stakeholders from around the state. Manchester-by-the-Sea has a new town planner. The Gloucester Times is reporting that Mark Resnick is now on the job, and he will be dealing with the state-mandated call for a transit-oriented zoning district to be created near the town's commuter rail station. Stephen Hagen writes that Resnick will need to navigate local political waters and work with town officials and board members to submit an MBTA zoning plan by the end of the year. Also in the Times today, the Rockport Housing Authority is looking for a director to manage and operate 80 units of elderly housing and 24 family units. The job was recently posted by the Rockport Housing Authority. Tourism is on the rise in Massachusetts, and according to Salem News reporter Caroline Enos, more support to cities and towns could be coming from the state legislature.
So kind of one of the most interesting things that they discussed is how we have to kind of approach tourism, right? So obviously there's a lot of art colonies and a lot of artists and performers and cultural kind of aspects of the North Shore that really have been celebrated and, you know, are the draw of why people come here besides, you know, the beautiful ocean and great food. So they had the executive director of the Mass Cultural Council, Michael Bobbitt, there, who really kind of drove home this point of making sure that, you know, hospitality businesses like restaurants, hotels, motels, venues, really working with local artists and kind of cultural organizations to mix the two together, because you're not going to have, you know, people coming here if you don't have a drive, and the drive a lot of times is culture and the people who are behind that. So that was really interesting. And, you know, we've also seen in the last kind of 8 years, you know, mainly during the Baker administration, that there hasn't been a lot of push for funding tourism from the state specifically. You know, obviously there's a lot of local organizations and, you know, great chamber of commerce and kind of business organizations like that, that kind of help drive funding locally. But this is really the first time in a while that we're seeing, you know, the governor's office kind of push this. And for the first time in 8 years, there's, you know, specifically in the budget, there's, you know, room for tourism in the, kind of, I shouldn't say budget, because, you know, there's always tourism in the budget, but, kind of in a plan to reevaluate the budget. There's really a concerted effort, from Maura Healey to, kind of up the spending and make it more of a priority, which is really encouraging for local organizations, you know, here in Salem, Gloucester, as you said. So, and we're also seeing an increase in tourism. In 2019, I think it was like, I want to say $25 billion spent by tourists in Massachusetts. And then in 2022, wow, after the pandemic, that increased by another $5 billion. So we're really, you know, a top attraction. But then when you look nationally, Massachusetts is only the number 46 when it comes to the state actually funding tourism. So there's a lot of work to be done, but there's also great work being done.
That's Salem News reporter Caroline Enos. In a new report, retailers in the downtown area of the city will be doing a new event that mirrors what they did in December. The Daily News reports this week that just about the time the Christmas tree is expected to come down in Market Square, many stores will remain open this Friday evening until 8 p.m. Reporter Jim Sullivan writes that this is similar to what was done during December for holiday shoppers, but now retailers are looking to spark business during one of the slower shopping times of the year. Newburyport Chamber of Commerce Director Nate Allard wants to keep the spirit of the December invitation nights alive year-round. Sports Next with Bill Newell, followed by North Shore Today Extra, featuring Salem News reporter Caroline Enos.
Hi, folks. This is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. Yes, we are a full-service lumber yard, but we also offer doors and windows and kitchen cabinets. Please visit us in Beverly, North Reading, and Plaistow, New Hampshire, or at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
If you're a soap bar user and you're always annoyed by the fact that when you use your entire bar, you're stuck with this little sliver of soap that you don't know what to do with, hold on, because I think I have the solution for you. It's always a pain to have that little sliver of soap that we didn't really know how to use but didn't want to waste and throw away. So we invented this cute cube-shaped soap bar that then you can place your old little soap sliver right into. There's a carved out X in the center of the bar that then you can place your old soap sliver into. You just break up that little sliver into pieces that are two or three and it fits right inside. And bam, now you've got a brand new soap bar and you didn't have to waste anything. If that's something you're interested in and you want to support a sustainable small business, then head on over to our shop at exobath.com. You can buy one for yourself or give it as a gift. It ships anywhere in the United States and you can get 20% off your first order.
Click on to the ExoBath banner at the top of our website. This is MSO Sports bringing voice to the North Shore. The Celtics beat the Pelicans last night, 118-112 at the Garden. Jason Tatum with 28 points, 10 rebounds. The Celts are right back at it tonight when they host the Pacers, 7:30 tip-off. The Bruins are off all this week for the NHL All-Star Week. In high school boys basketball from last night, two Cape Ann League powers posted wins last night, Manchester, Essex, and Newburyport. Tonight in local hoops, maybe the games of the night. On the boys' side, Peabody playing at Salem, 7 o'clock, while on the girls' side, Masconomet plays at Beverly. That's a 6 o'clock tip. The St. John's Prep hockey team has captured the Catholic Conference title. They're 12-1 on the season. This Wednesday night, they'll be taking on CM. Now, the Prep has won state titles, and in years they have not won league titles during those years. Our own Rick Moore asked Prep coach Christian Hansen, is it harder to almost win the Catholic Conference than it is to win a state title?
Yeah, well, I mean, there is some truth to that. So when I think about it as a player, honestly, it feels like yesterday was 1994, and we were going up against Catholic Memorial at that time, and CM was, I mean, they were a dynasty. They won the state title all 4 years that I was in high school. They were the team to beat. So my senior year, we had a really good group of seniors and probably one of our stronger teams. So we were able to compete pretty well with them. We split with them during the season. We ended up as co-champions of the conference, both of us losing just that one game against each other. So I do remember it pretty well, and it was satisfying at the time, and I guess it's fun still to look back at it.
The success year after year for Coach Chris Hansen leading the Prep has been really a steady-as-she-goes philosophy, staying the course.
We've kept the same kind of coaching system and philosophies throughout all these years,
mm-hmm.
Even when it comes to the amount of time we spend on each part of the game. And, you know, it's funny, it's unlike other sports where you're really limited by the amount of ice time that you have.
Mm-hmm.
So we have 60 minutes per day, and you have a full team of kids, and not everybody's on the power play. So you can't have a group of guys that sit there while other guys are doing the power play or penalty kill. So we basically take 10 minutes in practice, and that's our focus, would be power play. And then we move on to other things. So we try not to get stale with it. We try to, go over some teaching points and make sure everybody understands our system. But that's about what we designate per game on the ice. And then we have film time and videos and things that we watch off the ice, but on ice is relatively limited, really, in the big picture.
St. John's Prep coach Christian Hansen. This is North Shore Today, giving voice to the North Shore, the area's only daily news and sports podcast. Along with Rick Moore, I'm Bill Newell, hoping you have a great Tuesday. North Shore Today Extra is next.
If you're a soap bar user and you're always annoyed by the fact that when you use your entire bar, you're stuck with this little sliver of soap that you don't know what to do with, hold on, because I think I have the solution for you. It's always a pain to have that little sliver of soap that we didn't really know how to use but didn't want to waste and throw away. So we invented this cute cube-shaped soap bar that then you can place your old little soap sliver right into. There's a carved out X in the center of the bar that then you can place your old soap sliver into. You just break up that little sliver into pieces that are 2 or 3 and it fits right inside. And bam, now you've got a brand new soap bar and you didn't have to waste anything. If that's something you're interested in and you want to support a sustainable small business, then head on over to our shop at exobath.com. You can buy one for yourself or give it as a gift. It ships anywhere in the United States and you can get 20% off your first order.
Click on to the Exobath banner at the top of our website.
We are back in the Salem newsroom now, this time with Salem News reporter Caroline Enos. We were at the newsroom on Friday with Paul Layton and Dustin Luca, and you were missed, Caroline.
Oh, I miss being there.
Okay. But you were busy. You're on assignment, as they say. So much to talk about. And I, in a little pregame warm-up here, I just discovered that you have another reporter helping out now covering Danvers. So you're primarily in Peabody?
Yes. Yep. I have a break now, which is nice. Still plenty to write about, but I can kind of focus a little bit more there.
Okay. Yeah. Big, especially with Route 114 there. All right. I want to start with your most recent coverage in Monday's today's paper about North Shore tourism get together. There is obviously a big need for information among towns and cities with respect to tourism, because living on Cape Ann, I know that it's just growing by leaps and bounds. So tell me a little bit about what happened on Friday.
Yeah. So again, thank you for having me on as always. On Friday, I went and covered a tourism convention at the Marriott Hotel in Peabody, which really focused on, you know, tourism as a whole in Massachusetts, but specifically on the North Shore, which, as you said, obviously is so thriving between Salem, Gloucester, all of Cape Ann, everywhere. So kind of one of the most interesting things that they discussed is how we have to kind of approach tourism, right? So obviously, there's a lot of art colonies and a lot of artists and performers and cultural kind of aspects of the North Shore that really have been celebrated and, you know, are the draw of why people come here besides, you know, the beautiful ocean, and great food. So they had the executive director of the Mass Cultural Council, Michael Bobbitt there, who really kind of drove home this point of making sure that, you know, hospitality businesses like restaurants, hotels, motels, venues, really working with local artists and kind of cultural organizations to mix the two together, because you're not going to have, you know, people coming here if you don't have a drive, and the drive a lot of times is culture and the people who are behind that. So that was really interesting. And, you know, we've also seen in the last kind of 8 years, you know, mainly during the Baker administration, that there hasn't been a lot of push for funding tourism from the state specifically. You know, obviously there's a lot of local organizations and, you know, great chamber of commerce and kind of business organizations like that, that kind of help drive funding locally. But this is really the first time in a while that we're seeing, you know, the governor's office kind of push this. And for the first time in 8 years, there's, you know, specifically in the budget, there's, you know, room for tourism in the, kind of, I shouldn't say budget, because, you know, there's always tourism in the budget, but, kind of in a plan to reevaluate the budget. There's really a concerted effort, from Maura Healey to, kind of up the spending and make it more of a priority, which is really encouraging for local organizations, you know, here in Salem, Gloucester, as you said. So, and we're also seeing an increase in tourism. In 2019, I think it was like, I want to say $25 billion spent by tourists in Massachusetts. And then in 2022, wow, after the pandemic, that increased by another $5 billion. So we're really, you know, a top attraction. But then when you look nationally, Massachusetts is only the number 46 when it comes to the state actually funding tourism. So there's a lot of work to be done, but there's also great work being done. So that was really interesting to see come together.
Well, there's a great local connection there, obviously, because of Lieutenant Governor Kim Driscoll had Kate Fox as, you know, Destination Salem director. And of course, Discover Gloucester has learned from that model. And, you know, in Gloucester, we have Tess McCulgan, who mm-hmm. is sort of following that model and increasing everything. So that there's a real local connection there. Did you get to talk to Kate Fox?
Yeah, actually. So she was kind of the star of this convention, of course, obviously, because there's a lot of the Salem organizations and businesses there. So every time she got on the stand, everyone was pretty much cheering her name, quite literally at one point. So, you know, for people that don't know, she kind of was the Miss Salem Tourism. She ran Destination Salem, and now she's the executive director for the state's Office of Travel and Tourism. So I think it's great, you know, obviously, that you have someone who's been on the front lines of local tourism and possibly the busiest, I think, craziest part of local tourism on the North Shore. I mean, I know the beaches get a lot of stuff, but there's nothing quite like Halloween. So that was great to hear her talk and kind of her insight.
Well, that's interesting. That's pretty cool, because obviously it's an industry that is really growing as, I don't know, as people get more, have expendable income, I guess, and the climate changes, it gets warmer and warmer. So mm-hmm. all very interesting. Great coverage. Great story. Next up, we're going to talk trash.
Yes. Yeah. That's been a topic I've been covering a lot, actually. So when I was doing Danvers, you know, as a part of my full-time beat, up until recently, there was a lot of talk there about, you know, a new trash fee and making it an automatic or automated trash pickup, service. And they, you know, signed on with Republic Service, which kind of bought JRM hauling, which everyone on the North Shore pretty much used. So it was interesting to see the transition from that standpoint, but now in Peabody, there's some more, kind of transitional stuff. So like I said, Republic Services bought JRM back in 2022, I believe. And with that, they absorbed kind of JRM's contracts. So they didn't start new contracts with their clients. They just continued them out. And as you read in PBD, it's been a bumpy ride, to say the least. You know, it seems like every week there are neighborhoods that don't get their trash picked up on time. Sometimes there's, you know, delays as many as 2 days. And obviously that's not great, especially in the summer when there's trash and it's, you know, blowing on the street and it smells and it's not great. So the city kind of, you know, gave them an adjustment period where it's like, okay, you know, they've just taken this over. We're going to kind of work out the kinks, but you know, it's January now. They took that over back in the summer officially, maybe in the spring. So it's not been great. But one of the big reasons for why it was kind of, there were these huge delays that were really making problems for residents was because the trash hauler trucks had to go to a facility in Haverhill to offload, which had long wait times. That facility sounded like it was kind of, you know, had a lot of, I would say, traffic going into it. And once you got there, trucks would be there for 2 hours just sitting there sometimes, which obviously if they had to get back into another run in Peabody, that delayed that. So it was really just kind of a mess. But they recently, on January 20th, switched to working or to bringing trash to a site in Danvers. So hopefully, fingers crossed, that should help with the issues. But, you know, it's good that there was an effort to fix it. I think there's also frustration because the effort came now and not earlier. I know City Councilor Tom Ross acknowledged that, you know, if you read the story, he talked to me about this, but he was very frustrated because, you know, he had hoped that the company would have worked on this earlier since they knew it was an issue earlier. Back in December, he filed a, or he suggested a resolution for a Republic Service representative to come to the City Council to talk about what the issues are. That passed unanimously. He still kind of, he said he told me, he's playing email tag with the company trying to set up that date. But, it's good that there has been change, he said, but this should have happened earlier. And also it's frustrating for people because you don't think that trash is a huge deal until it's on your curb smelling. Right. So,
yeah. Well, I know at WESX when I was over there, the biggest reaction that we got from the public was when Marblehead dog walkers talked about scooping the dog poop. And it was just all hell broke loose. So I understand that. As a reporter, Caroline, now something like this, do you have, I don't know, a schedule, a calendar or something where there's something coming up and you have to go check on that again with, let's say, with respect to this trash situation, an event, or is it just kind of random and you just have to sort of every day make calls?
It definitely depends on the story. I mean, you know, when things are in committee and city council or being discussed, you know, by the planning board, you know, committees like that, it's pretty easy to track them because, you know, okay, at the next meeting, there's a good chance it'll be on the agenda. So check the agenda for that day. And then if it's on that agenda, great. I know on that day, I'm going to go and report on that. But then when it's stuff kind of anecdotally in the works, you know, things that aren't necessarily right in front of officials' eyes, or at least I should say that aren't in front of, you know, what they're talking about at those meetings or aren't a part of that, it's kind of definitely a lot of looking on Facebook, seeing what people are saying, if it's still talked about locally, you know, just kind of keeping an eye out on, I guess that's the biggest thing is to try to gauge, residents' discussions. And social media has obviously made that really, really easy to do. And then there's also just, you know, I know it's a thing that's happening. And even if I don't hear about it, it's like, okay, well, it's been a while since I've heard about this. I should ask someone if they've heard anything new.
but social media is a source.
Yes. Yes. It's a huge source. And I know, obviously, we're kind of pushing away from Twitter, but even there, it's like, even though we're not really posting to Twitter anymore, because it's become a cesspool, there's still great conversations going on there that aren't, you know, toxic. There are still, you know, focus on local issues, and between that and Facebook, it's really helpful for me for sure, and every other reporter.
I got to tell you, I was watching a video last night on the greatest trash talker of all time, Larry Bird.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to put you in that category, but I appreciate your coverage on that. And now, finally, Caroline, a more serious note: there was a former Holocaust survivor named Sonia Weitz from Peabody who did wonderful work over the years in school. She visited schools all over the North Shore, recounting her experiences and so on. And I know a lot of former students who now as adults reflect on that still to this day on her ability to discuss this. You had a more recent experience the more recent experience in Peabody that you wrote about?
Yes. So on the 27th, so this weekend, was International Holocaust Remembrance Day. And every year, the Lapin Foundation, obviously, which they do a lot of programming around this. The Lapin Foundation is really about Holocaust education and also fostering a sense of Jewish community and identity, which is really important, especially as you listen to these stories of Holocaust survivors that are, you know, much more not as frequent now, since we're really at the end of that living history, since these people are in their 90s and even 100s. So the survivor that I got to listen to, it was over Zoom. He was in Western Mass, is where he lives now. So I didn't get to see him in person, but honestly, when you're listening to the story, it doesn't really matter when they're right in front of you. His name is Warner Salinger. He is turning 92. His story is a little different because, you know, usually when you think of the Holocaust survivor, you think of someone who escaped the camps or has survived the camps or, you know, witnessed their entire family kind of die in the worst parts of the Holocaust. And with him, he was able to escape right after Kristallnacht, which is this, you know, horrible night on November 1938, where the Nazis and, you know, even just regular German people who weren't soldiers or weren't really high up in the party went and raided and destroyed, you know, Jewish stores, synagogues, homes. They even rounded up, you know, that was one of the first mass roundups of Jewish residents where they sent them right to the camps. So he was 6 years old watching that happen from his apartment window. And obviously when you're six, you don't really fully understand what's happening. But he said that even to this day, he could still smell that acrid smoke from coming from a synagogue down the street. So, it, you know, hearing that is just so powerful. And, you know, thankfully him and his parents were able to flee the country right after that and came to America. And then once he got to America, he became friends with Albert Einstein, oddly enough.
Wow.
So yeah, he went and stayed with relatives because sadly his mother died right after they got to America from tuberculosis, which is so sad to think that she escapes that just to come here and not get to live the life that she wanted. But his grandmother was friends with Albert Einstein's caretaker and they lived down the street from him. So whenever she would go and visit her friend, she'd bring him with him and with her. And Albert Einstein would bring him through his gardens and play music for him on his violin because he loved children. And, and, you know, Warner was about 9 at the time. So it's so cool to see what he got to live through. And then also crazy enough, he went back to Germany as a member of the U.S. Air Force in the 1950s during the Cold War. And he married the daughter of a Nazi soldier. So
wow. Yeah. You can't make this up. Yep.
You cannot make this up. You know, he was hesitant to tell her that he was Jewish and that he had fled with his family, you know, back in 1938. But when he did, her and her family did not care. They were pretty progressive Germans. Her father had been drafted into the war, so he didn't want to fight. And he was able to get out because he got injured on the front lines while trying to press into the Soviet Union. So, you know, they weren't sympathizers. They were more so regular German people. And to hear that him say, oh, I love my father-in-law and he loves me. It's like that's so important to hear, especially now, since, as he discussed, there's just a rise in anti-Semitism, a rise in Holocaust denial, which is terrifying. It's like I said, because we're losing this living memory with the deaths of these survivors. So it's important for organizations like the Lapin Foundation and, you know, everyday people to really pass on these stories and these experiences.
Oh, I think it's important that you do stories like that. And being a very young person, your understanding of it is so, in my opinion, I'm an old guy now, and what I see happening worldwide, and especially to oppressed populations, I guess, and especially the Jews. It just, I always thought when I was your age, by the 21st century, we'd be living on the moon. We'd be all together as a global family. And it's important, I think. My dad, just one quick anecdote. My dad was in the army. We were in Germany in the 60s. And in 1960, I think I was in the sixth or seventh grade. He was on some kind of a winter duty. And they visited I think it was Dachau. And this was now 15 years after the end of the war. And he was away for a month. And when he came home, he was just shook to his core. And he was an Iwo Jima survivor. He was on Iwo Jima.
Wow.
But he wouldn't tell us. He mentioned a couple of things that just, you know, so many years after the war were still there. And to have people not understand that this was a real historical event is maddening in this country. And
yep.
As an American educator, it just won't do. So thank you for what you did. Thank you for covering that.
Yeah. I mean, it was so interesting. And actually, I actually visited Dachau when I went to Germany, back in October. So
wow.
For me, it was like seeing this history in action in a different way. And I'll give a quick plug. There is a Holocaust museum coming to Boston right next to Suffolk University on Tremont Street. They're trying to get that up, I think, by 2025 or 20 in the next few years. So it'll be great to have something a little bit more localized, because they do plan to focus on the survivors who came here and even the Nazis who lived here, because there are pictures of brownstones on Beacon Hill in the 1930s with swastika flags out front. So I'm glad to see that there's a real concerted effort to preserve this.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you've done good in school, so I'm glad to hear that, you know, and that you understand stuff at such a young and tender age. Caroline, anything else that you want to mention that maybe you're working on or following up on, or that grabs your interest?
See, the fun thing about working on a ton at once is as soon as you publish something, you kind of forget you wrote it. I'm sure I can answer that question in some way, but yeah.
Okay.
My best advice is just to look at the front page.
Okay.